In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
It's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Out of about 15 or so near-death experience testimonies I recently viewed, several people emphasized how they were sent back from the other side to deliver a message to humanity. The message is essentially that your thoughts, feeling, and intention create your reality. In one testimony, a woman was left to die from an overdose, her body found amid the trash in an alley. She was hospitalized and revived. In one of her videos, she mentioned Neville Goddard's work that centers around exercises to focus your intention and create your own reality. Neville Goddard was a British Barbadian born in the West Indies in 1905. He was a writer, speaker, and mystic. Neville Goddard published up to 14 books, beginning with the 1939 book titled At Your Command. I'm thinking about why those on the other side need this message to reach people here in this incarnation, and why now? There are several past shows that have parallels with Neville Goddard's power of assumption and being in the wish-fulfilled state known to cause a shift in reality. Those shows also involve unique ways in using your mind, such as the interviews with Dr. Kahili King, author of Instant Healing, and Dr. Mary Hardy's work. On the opposite spectrum, past guest Jerry Marcinski reveals an active etheric parasite, not a chemical imbalance in the brain, but actual entities tormenting schizophrenics. There is a connection here with Goddard's work as well. Neville Goddard explains how being in the present moment in the wish-fulfilled state causes reality to reflect back, not what you want, but who you are. By assuming the conditions you wish to create, you then reshape your reality. This place of creation must include feeling, emotions, the language of the subconscious. When you imagine how it would feel in these wish-fulfilled states, the universe has no choice but to make it so. Goddard says, quote, "When fear knocks, answer with faith. When doubt creeps in, and it will, return to assumption." We talk about these dynamics with our guest Tom Montauk, who recently wrote an article titled, "How Can I Feel Myself to Be One with the Infinite Creator?" Tom Montauk is a seasoned researcher of fringe topics who draws on his scientific background to unravel the mysteries of reality. His website, montauk.net, that's MONTALK.net, covers 30 years of research into spiritual awakening, synchronicity, and the hidden mechanics of reality. Tom, welcome to another news.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks so much for having me on.
For full disclosure, those tuning into this show have been listening to interviews with your partner, Carissa Conti, for many years, and it's an honor now as well to have you on. In the introduction, I mentioned how by watching near-death experience videos, several witnesses explained how they were sent back to tell people how important our thoughts, feelings, and intention are in creating our reality. Could there be a point of no return approaching as populations become tempted to rely on freely available experimental artificial intelligence tools? Is there a use-it-or-lose-it critical mass approaching, or is there a significant deficit of humans not utilizing this important gift and are at risk of getting short-shrifted in life?
No, that's an excellent question, because we are at a pivotal moment in human history, actually, with the development of AI and robotics and all these new technologies coming online. And if we look historically at the trajectory of technologies and how it's influenced humanity, well, science and technology has gotten better, but spiritually, humanity has almost descended into a kind of dark age, right? Because if you consider like the medieval times, people back then, they had much better artistic imagination abilities. They were more spiritual. They had more complicated music. And nowadays you turn on the radio and the music is extremely simple and popular music is kind of base, I guess you could say. And people are in a more kind of nihilistic, lost, anti-spiritual state nowadays. So the question is, how will AI affect this? And in my opinion, I think AI is one of those tools where it's like a fancy calculator. So if you use it only as a fancy calculator for mechanical tasks like searching or summarizing or coding or analyzing, then it's okay because that's a lot of drudgery that if you were to spend your entire day doing that, it would actually detract from you being able to be more yourself, be more creative. However, if you rely on AI too much for those things that should come from the soul, that should come from your imagination, then those abilities of your soul begin to atrophy. And that's a big risk that we're facing because Neville Goddard mentions how important it is to use your imagination ability to shape the kinds of experiences that you attract to yourself in life. And that's not only true for you individually, but also for humanity collectively. So if collectively we lose our ability to go within and to tap into our spiritual power, then our lives will be entirely at the mercy of a technocratic, AI-driven reality. And that's not good either, because that puts the power into the hands of the people that control that system instead of our higher spirit. So that's sort of the crux that we are facing. So personally, I like using AI for mechanical things, but I swear to never ever use it for creative abilities like writing an article or coming up with new ideas, you know, brainstorming, writing music in my case. Now, some people do that, that's okay, but for me, I do want to preserve that ability within myself.
And I didn't mention that in your bio, but listeners, Tom Montauk is also a musician. While we're just briefly talking about this, Tom, can you tell listeners where to find some of the music that you're producing?
Oh, sure. So it's funny enough, even when I was a kid, I've always been into rock and metal and classical. So that trajectory has continued, and I make, well, essentially metal with some symphonic elements here and there. So if you're interested, you can go to my YouTube channel. Just look up Tom Montauk on YouTube, M-O-N-T-A-L-K, and you'll find my channel there. And I've got Fringe Knowledge videos. I have my album from 2011 and a couple songs since that time, and a few more projects that I'll be adding over time.
Recently, looking at some videos where people are posting AI videos that are known to elicit an emotional response from people. And there was one criticism I heard that some of the messages she got back from her criticism about, I don't know if it's okay for these AI productions to zero in on specific pieces of music or art that will guarantee to bring the human emotion out, to bring tears to somebody. There's just something wrong about that. It's almost as if the AI is using people to elicit emotion. Do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, I think one of the fundamental reactions that people have against that is that it's technology intruding upon something sacred, something personal. Because emotion, feelings, they come from the soul, you know? And if technology replicates that artificially without any human doing that, then it's almost a crime against the spirit to have essentially a rock, you know, silicon, which gets turned into a CPU or GPU, which, you know, runs the AI. It's kind of sacrilege for that to enter the inner spiritual sanctum of our soul and draw emotion out of it. I think that's what's happening subconsciously with people when they react to it. Now, in my opinion, I think just, you know, the same way that if you want to communicate a certain emotion through singing, for example, you're using your mechanical voice box in your throat, using your larynx to do that, and someone hears it with their mechanical ears, and it gets translated into a soul impulse. You are indeed working through a kind of mechanical system to do that, and AI is sort of like that. So I think the only way to use it correctly is if the artist has full command over the AI and uses it to express their own inner soul impulse, so that it's not just a blind machine coming up with it on its own, but it's doing the command of its creator, you could say. I think that's the only way that you could sort of justify that.
British investigative journalist and author Jenny Randles wrote in her book titled Time Storms, quote, "In essence, matter was found to comprise a flux, a myriad of energy fields whose complex interactions created what to our eyes often appear as particles. Nevertheless, this discovery proved that at a fundamental level, all reality was immaterial and not rock solid, but in truth, a sea of invisible radiation energy in the form of waves," end quote. Is the fabric of our reality a pliable substrate for our conscious minds to interface with? Or, asked a different way, is the human mind designed to interface with the pliable substrate made up of waves at the subatomic level? Tom, would you please talk about what may be happening on a metaphysical level when a person correctly embodies the wish-fulfilled state, holds it, and causes reality to rearrange itself?
Well, that really is the crux of the topic that we're discussing, because this is the mechanism that makes it all work. So we have to understand possibly how it could work in order to give credence to the idea of Neville Goddard's technique. Okay. So what Jenny Randles is talking about there, she's talking essentially about quantum physics, quantum field theory, the standard model, the idea that when we look around and we see solid matter around us, that solidity is ultimately an illusion, because if you were to zoom in far enough, you would see nothing but vibrations, waves, energy, fields. Okay, there's no actual like solid particles. It's just fields and little excitations in those fields. However, all that quantum stuff, that's merely the last step in a sequence of steps that initially begins within the realm of greater consciousness outside of physicality. So I think one of the best ways to understand that reality is ultimately vibration, energy, and consciousness is to think about how things work inside your nightly dreams, okay? So when you're in your dream, you, the dreamer, all the characters in your dream, and the dream environment, those are all different facets or projections of the same exact consciousness, which is you. So all of it is happening inside of you, and yet you feel different. You feel different from all the different dream characters from your dream environment, but it's all the same thing. So when you're in a dream, okay, what happens if you were to just relax, focus, call up a particular emotion or wish, and you immerse yourself into that energetic template? Well, what happens is the dream itself begins to change to reflect that. And how does it do that? Well, it's because when you focus upon a particular idea or visual or emotion, it percolates down into your subconscious, which is generating the dream environment, and then percolates back up into the dream environment. So you're literally looking at your intentions, your emotions manifesting outwardly in the dream, but it can only work because it's all happening within your soul or your consciousness. So now consider then what happens in the waking world that we all share. Well, it turns out that yes, Buddhists and Hindus and native traditions all over the world say everything is part of a single great spirit. Everything is part of a single universal mind, you could say. But it's more complicated than that, because it's not just a universal mind. There's also a kind of universal subconscious, which the ancient Greeks called the demiurge. And this demiurge is like the soul of the universe. It's like the subconscious of reality. And it is what projects and fashions the physical environment that we find ourselves within. Just as our own subconscious does within dreams, this demiurge does to all of us in waking reality. So actually, you know, there is not much of a difference then between a dream and reality, other than the fact that we have a bigger, more universal subconscious projecting this space, holding it all together, and making it way more persistent and logical and precise, you know, with physics and biology and chemistry and all those mathematical laws, than our own nightly dreams. So in that sense, our own nightly dreams are more like a low-resolution, small-scale AI model that generates an environment, whereas in waking reality, you've got the supercomputer as a metaphor, the supercomputer generating reality with a lot of persistence and so on. However, our own subconscious is actually tied into the universal subconscious the same way that a single tree in a forest is tied into the entire forest through the root system. So when you turn within and you access your subconscious, or you impress a particular vision or emotion or deep assumption or belief upon it, it kind of goes down into the very root of your being and through that root system into the greater demiurge that affects all of reality. And so in that way, by changing your own subconscious, you change your external reality. Now, the difference, of course, between, as I mentioned, between your nightly dreams and waking reality is that waking reality has this, you know, universal thing, and we are all together in this reality, sharing it together. So it's kind of like everyone being tied together by a rope. We're all in a coupled system. So therefore, things happen a little bit more slowly in reality than they do in our nightly dreams, but they still happen. So it just takes a little bit more time. It might be a little bit more indirect, but it still happens. And that's sort of the key to understanding how this can work and why Neville Goddard's techniques are effective if you apply them correctly.
I like the forest, the tree roots of the forest connection, because that references the mycelium of the fungus, right? Connecting all the roots in the forest as the medium communication. And the supercomputer of the brain, the conscious mind interfacing with reality, not in the dream state, just in the waking life. Goddard said it in a presentation how an event took place where I think it was a Navy ship or some kind of cargo ship was hijacked and taken over. Big event in the news. And he was pointing out how several weeks before, a woman wrote a piece of fiction that detailed the exact event. And he is saying, is it possible this woman created that reality in her fictional article, that, you know, one of her courses in university? And it made me think, Tom, about these weird books that we see on Amazon that were published before like a big event that have all these false flag things attached to it. It speaks to the power of the conscious mind that may have this extra part imbued with emotion that may create a reality. We may not be aware of this.
Yeah, this is actually a well-known thing within the field of writing novels. Like, so novelists, a sort of a thing that a lot of times they will encounter in the real world a character that they completely made up for a novel that they wrote years or months earlier. And the thing is, sometimes these characters are quite specific, even improbable, you know, kind of fantastical. But still, they will encounter it in the real world, which is really strange. Like, how can that happen? Well, it does make perfect sense. So if we are sharing a kind of collective dream, and if you energize a particular thought enough, it can be input into this universal subconscious and eventually over time pop up in your life. You know, it's crazy to consider, but that can definitely happen. Now, in other cases, of course, maybe a person was clairvoyant or precognitive and they just tapped into a future that was already on its way. You know, that's possible too. However, with precognition, you're only tuning into what could happen or what will happen, whereas with Goddard, we're talking about something where you can choose what you want to happen, and you do a certain kind of thing, the techniques that he talks about, and it manifests, okay? I mean, whether you do it intentionally or you do it unintentionally, like a novelist, when they're writing, they're really they're immersing themselves in that fictional world, right? So because they imbue it with thought, with emotion, and they're almost in a kind of trance state when they're writing, well, those are the three ingredients that you need to make this work. So really, from a technical viewpoint, it's no surprise that people who write things very often, well, I don't know how often it is, but it's not uncommon, let's call it that. So it's not uncommon that they will manifest the very thing that they've been imagining very intensely.
If you're just tuning in, our guest is Tom Montauk, and he is a seasoned researcher on fringe topics. We're talking about the work of Neville Goddard and manifesting reality. Tom, here again, Neville Goddard is repeating a concept in many different ways, that by holding the wish-fulfilled state, reality will begin to align with the inner state of being. Past guest, Dr. Mary Hardy, calculates an astronomical measurement showing how sensitive our thoughts and intentions are. In her book, titled Pyramid Energy, she writes about how the weak fields of electromagnetic energy constantly modify the relationship with our surroundings. The significance of telepathy, she writes, quote, is but a response to a very weak electromagnetic signal. Early measurements suggested the average neuron synapse energy interchange is in the order of 10 to the 15th power of a watt. And those early measurements are from universities in the UK and the United States. For reference, the output of a single candle flame is internationally given in the spherical measurement as 0.1847931 of a watt. This number now must be diminished by 10 to the 15th, or 0.000, that's 15 zeros, 1846931. So she writes, if one candle's light is gathered in a spherical condition and taken as one, then we can interpolate that the human brain responds to a signal of 100 trillion times smaller. Now we can see the relationship of true sensitivity. Such small, weak fields move incredibly fast. It is the sensitivity, she writes, of all creation to all creation, which is the only path to true progress. In a nutshell, one can speak, write, or think whatever one likes, but unless it is an action, word, or thought conceived in humble, simple love, it is wrong. We're all mostly unaware of this staggering measurement of our own sensitivity, yet Dr. Hardy emphasizes and holds you accountable to an ethical standard. With this innate ability, Tom, and based on your research into this world of manifestation and multiple aspects of spirituality, would this spiritual law Goddard references also allow the creation of negative and foul manifestation?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So before I get into that, I do want to address what she said about the incredibly small amount of power that our neurons operate on. So it's interesting because besides electromagnetism, there are other forms of energy or waves that exist, one example being what's called the quantum potential or Bohmian potential. It's a facet of the quantum wave function, which is the waves that underlie reality. It's a facet of that which does not diminish with distance. So you can have an electron on the other side of the universe having a quantum potential that affects a couple neurons in your brain here. Okay, so what that means is that everything is connected and interacting at a quantum level. Interestingly enough, the power of thought, including the power of telepathy, it's not so much about raw power, like, you know, getting on a megaphone and yelling really loudly to reach someone a couple hundred yards away. It's not about power. It's more about coherence, alignment, and synchronization. So you can think of it like a tiny key and a little turn of the wrist can open a giant vault door, which a huge sledgehammer, you could beat on the door all day and you're not going to open it. So raw power isn't always a solution to everything. Sometimes it's about having the right code to access a specific function. And that really is the essence, I think, of Goddard's technique and how consciousness interfaces with the brain, like how the soul, the spirit, interfaces with the biological brain. It's not strictly through raw power. It is through having the right access codes or the right interactions to be able to specifically influence a very sensitive system, which is what the human brain is. It's a very sensitive system. So I just wanted to talk about that a little bit. So back to your question then, you asked whether the occult laws of manifesting allows also for the creation of negative and foul manifestations. So there are different kinds of negative manifestations. The simplest one is where you attract situations in life that are very suffering-inducing, that are very harrowing to go through. You know, negative experiences, accidents, illness, misfortunes, fights, breakups, things like that. A lot of these very painful experiences, they can be attracted more than they need to be. Because on the one hand, right, there's a lot of people that say, if I had to do it all over again, I would do it all over again because it made me stronger as a person. So a lot of times pain and suffering can make us better. But I think we also have the freedom to attract more of it than is necessary for our own good, especially in the sense that it wastes a lot of time and energy, and maybe we could have become stronger in a shorter period of time, but because we were stubborn and in this negative feedback loop, we attracted more of it than we should have. So that's one example of doing it. And the way that that would work, for example, is if you spend most of your day, especially after you wake up in the morning and you're laying there and you're kind of ruminating in your mind about all your problems, your fears, your anxieties, your resentments and hatreds of this person or that person, if you get into that mode, especially in that half awake, half asleep state, that is the most effective way to manifest reality. And except for in this particular case, you're doing it in a negative way because you're latching onto all those probable futures that reinforce more of those same emotions and feelings and thoughts and beliefs. So it's important to understand that the way our reality works is it works almost like a, well, it does work like a feedback loop system where the experiences that we have tempt us to think about them or react to them in a certain way. And we have free will choice about how to do that. I mean, if you experience a misfortune, do you react by becoming extremely freaked out, even more negative, even more depressed, you know? Or do you say, well, it is what it is. I have faith that it's going to work out and I'll do my best to make it work out. See, those are two opposite approaches to the exact same experience. And which one you choose reinforces its corresponding feedback loop. So if you choose the positive approach, then maybe the next time an experience like that comes, it'll actually work out this time. And then you'll feel better. And then because you feel better, it'll make the next one work out even better. And eventually you don't even get them anymore, right? So through this feedback loop mechanism, you end up shifting towards a more positive timeline for yourself. Or conversely, you can go down the negative path and that becomes like a snowball rolling down a hill and gets worse and worse and worse. So we have to take control of our feedback loops by deciding whenever we're confronted with these challenges, how we're going to react to it. And ideally, we would react to it in a positive way. So attracting negative experiences like that, that's one form of foul manifestation that you're alluding to. But there is also another form which gets more into the field of occultism and the topic of thought forms, tulpas, or what are called egregores. And what these are subtle energy constructs, almost like little AIs that can take the form of beings, entities, little astral animals or something, but they're non-physical constructs that are the emanations of your own soul energy that take external form within the non-physical energy field environment that we are surrounded by, you know, because there's a physical plane, but there's also other planes that are stacked atop that, which we can't see with our eyes, but if you're psychic or you go out of body or you have a near-death experience, then you can experience these other parallel invisible planes that are around us. And our thoughts and our feelings can create these thought form type entities in this plane. So, and the way that they're created is through focused thought, focused emotion, and well, also focused belief, you know, very much like Goddard's technique. So what happens then is that if you steep yourself in extremely negative emotions and thoughts and feelings for a long time, and not just negative in the sense of depression, but also any kind of base emotion that animal desires, greed, envy, hatred, those kinds of things, if you do that for too long, too often, it can create, as I mentioned, an externalized thought form entity that takes on a life of its own. And this entity then becomes parasitic and tries to make you, through a kind of telepathic or psychic influence, make you engage in more of those same behaviors that create more of that energy that it then feeds upon. And it can become so strong that it doesn't even need to feed on you anymore. It's now strong enough to affect other people in your vicinity and make them engage in those kinds of behaviors. So negativity in that sense can spread. And that ties into the Native American idea of the Wendigo or Wetiko, which Paul Levi talks about. He talks about this idea of this dark etheric parasite. And also, Marzinski, that's what he talks about as well. These etheric thought forms or demons, as you might want to call them, whatever they are, they have the ability to be created by one person and spread to others. Or, you know, maybe they are not created by us, but they are something more primordial. But either way, these are precisely, exactly, foul manifestations, spiritually foul manifestations that can have a parasitic effect on you individually and also on humanity as a whole. And that's why it is actually in the interest of the dark powers that be, not just the human psychopaths that run government and corporations, but also occult powers that are not even physical. It's in their interest that humanity gets as spiritually beat down as possible and focus as much on animal desires and negativity as possible in order to generate these parasitic thought forms that then create a feedback loop which keep us even more down, make us even more victims, and therefore make these predators stronger and stronger and stronger. So if there's any like major takeaway that we can get from Goddard, it is that we as individuals and as collective humanity need to take control of our creative abilities and practice spiritual hygiene and make sure that we are spinning up these positive feedback loops that can move us towards a more positive future.
I didn't even think about the unintentional, the unwitting thought form that mutates into this apparition eventually. I really don't think about that because it's almost taking Carl Jung's theory on the shadow and animating it as something that becomes real, breaks out of the cage in effect. So that's the unintentional and unwitting part there. Can somebody interface with the quantum substrate intentionally cause harm to other people?
Yeah, they can definitely do that. And that's what black magic really is. Psychic attacks, spiritual warfare. People can do it. Dark occult masters are very effective at that. And also non-physical dark beings, which some people might call demons, they can do such a thing. I mean, that's what they specialize in, because being non-physical, it's not like they have to go to work and pay taxes and, you know, do all the boring stuff we have to do. They dedicate their time to perfecting the art of spreading spiritual darkness in this world, if not this entire universe. So that's what they can do. And what it means, therefore, is that metaphysics, the structure of reality, occultism, all that stuff, it's a neutral medium, it's a neutral tool that can be used for good or for evil, depending on the free will of the being doing it. Now, in our case, if we're talking strictly about thought forms, they are not really sentient, they're more like artificial intelligences, so they don't really have free will, they just have programming that is imbued into them by who? By us reinforcing them, creating them through very intense, prolonged thoughts, feelings, and beliefs. And so these things, they act as what in chaos theory is called a strange attractor. And what a strange attractor is, it's a kind of energy field that bends probability towards itself. So, for example, if you were to create a thought form of depression, either on purpose or unintentionally, then this thought form will have the effect of inducing depression in anyone it comes in contact with. So, you know, that's how particular emotions can spread. And what you're asking about is whether that can be done intentionally, and the answer, of course, is yes.
You mentioned the work of past guest Jerry Marzinski. He worked with schizophrenics and revealed the voices aren't hallucinations, but actual entities feeding off the patient's negative emotional state. I suspect the human adversary, such as the composite corporate media narrative or the etheric parasite Marzinski mentions, would benefit having people to be pining about something in the past or worried about future events. It's a challenging spiritual exercise and discipline, but when mastered, in my opinion, being in the present moment would dispel low-level anxiety and possibly etheric parasites. Pining about something in the past, such as a relationship or wishing you could undo a past action, will take you out of fully being in the present. Worrying about the future pulls you out of the present moment, that state of being needed to embody the wish-fulfilled state. Tom, would you please comment on the lack of traction anxiety and fear have on a person when holding a state of being in that present moment? And who benefits when people are stuck in the past or worry about the unfolding of future events?
So as to the question of who benefits from it, it kind of circles back to what I mentioned in my last reply, which is that we're talking about the dark powers of this world, including the thought forms, including dark occult masters. Even if we talk in terms of ufology, there are certain non-human beings that we might consider aliens that feed on our emotional / life force energy. So that's sort of the milieu that we're talking about here. But regarding the past and the future and how that can benefit them, well, yeah, of course, if you are hung up on the past due to major regrets or pining for some event that you wish could have been different, or you're focused too much on the future in an unfulfilled state, those two things, they both lead to suffering. And suffering generates emotional energy, and that emotional energy goes where your attention goes. So there are beings out there, including thought forms, that will lap it up and get stronger as a result. Now, of course, the past and the future in themselves are not problems. It is more what past, what future, and how you feel or think about it. That is where the issue arises. Because Goddard himself, he says, well, if you want to focus on the past, you can reimagine the past as the way you wish it would have gone, but you focus on it as if it were the fact right now in the present. Okay, as if you had jumped timelines, and in the present, you're kind of reminiscing about the past, which is actually different from the one that you came from the other timeline. So that particular method, which I think he calls revisioning, that method is also quite effective for manifesting reality. Because when you revision the past, what that does is it changes the patterns, the quantum patterns in the present, so that you start attracting a different probable future. Now, he mentioned some amusing examples of people that have done that. And if you ever research his work and like what he says about that, those anecdotes are quite amusing. And they're a little bit too long for me to get into. But the point is, yeah, you can think about the past, you can think about the future, but make sure that you always re-anchor it back into the present. Because the present is the fulcrum where your action is most effective. It is the eye of the storm, the place of calmness. It is where you can act, you know, it is where you have your power. So in the end, no matter how much you think about the future or the past, in the end, you must return to the present, because that is where the power is, either in the form of the imagination techniques that Goddard talks about, or in the form of physical action, because you can't act in the future, can't act in the past, you can only act now, right? So people who are only ever thinking about the future or the past, not only do they get hung up on shames and regrets and resentments, or things that they wish they could have in the future, but, you know, they have anxiety over whether it'll happen or not, or futures that they fear, right? You don't only get hung up on that, but you also become disempowered because you're never actually acting in the present, whether metaphysically or physically.
Tom, I didn't know that Neville Goddard was using that technique of revising a past event, because I was going to mention the author I mentioned earlier, Dr. Serge Kahale King, author of Instant Healing and many other books, including Earth Energies. Dr. King suggests a similar technique in one of his chapters, where you would attain a meditative state, retrieve a traumatic past event, and reimagine it as positive. But now learning that because you're in the present moment, that reimagined positive memory activates the quantum field to reflect positive events into your life. I didn't know that, so I appreciate you pointing that out. Goddard says something very interesting. Quote, "Everything you desire is already yours the moment you claim it in consciousness. It's immediate." That reminds me of the premise of the book Instant Healing, which is the body wants to heal immediately, and our conscious and subconscious mind keep it from healing at that rate. The mind is holding on to trauma or has been programmed to believe certain conditions take X amount of days, months, or years to heal, which I might guess 99% of the time is not the case. Back to Goddard, he said simply by having a desire, that desire at that moment begins to come into reality. Tom, I wonder about how Goddard emphasizes the importance of emotion being the language of the subconscious and the centerpiece of causing reality to rearrange itself to reflect the person's state of being. It does imply that artificial intelligence can't interface with the subatomic and quantum levels in this way. It also implies those on antidepressant medication or some type of emotional suppressing treatment may also find limited results. Would you please talk about these concepts?
Yeah, so you're totally correct that AI, as it currently exists, it's, as I mentioned, it's just a fancy calculator. So it doesn't actually have emotions, and it doesn't even have convictions. It only has programming. There's nothing coming from the soul. You know, like when you have conviction, you feel something deep down, like from the heart, from the soul. An AI is a machine. It's a computer program. It doesn't have that. So there is actually no way that AI, as it currently exists, has any kind of Goddard-style reality manifesting abilities. And the more we ourselves become like AI, divorced from our own inner soul capacities to manifest, the more we will be trapped within a world of mechanical matter, unable to call upon our magical abilities to help us out of a bind. So that's a major risk that we're facing. Yeah.
Definitely, yes. Those on antidepressants, I know this is probably not an easy question to answer, but they may get short shrifted here too if they begin to take conscious control of their manifestation. I'm not sure about that, but I just wonder.
Thanks for reminding me, because I forgot to address that. Yeah, you're totally right that people who are on, well, it's not just people on antidepressant medication, it's also people who have fried out their neurotransmitter receptors, you know, dopamine receptors on social media, short form videos. All these things that give you instant gratification over and over and over again, eventually you kind of become burned out and jaded, and your attention span drops to near zero. So, well, how does that relate to Goddard's technique? Well, in Goddard's technique, you need focused attention, emotion, and you need to have some level of conviction. And those three things are being decimated by modern social media and short-form video content. So yeah, I mean, there is a spiritual war happening on our spiritual power, and we have to be aware of it because it's on our phones, it's right under our noses, it's in our houses, and we have to practice a level of moderation about that to avoid losing our innate spiritual faculties. So specifically regarding people on antidepressants, this is an important point because when Goddard talks about his manifesting technique, he talks not only about feeling. He also talks about your root assumptions and your core beliefs, which are, you know, two sides of the same coin. So what that means, therefore, is that in theory, you can get away with manifesting without having all that much emotion so long as the very core or root of your being, and we're talking here about your subconscious, really, so long as your subconscious is invested in the idea. And there are other means than emotion of getting the subconscious to be in alignment with that. So one of those methods, for example, is this. I have had times in life where maybe I was daydreaming. I was kind of like looking at a wall, in a tranced out state, kind of dazing off, imagining something. And there really wasn't all that much emotion in it. But my entire being was involved in it. It was immersed in it. It was visualizing it. It was kind of going along with it. And it might have only lasted 20 seconds, but later that day, that very thing that I was sort of daydreaming about, it actually happened for real. I manifested it without a ton of emotion, only because my conscious mind was out of the way and I was sort of sunk down into the subconscious state, you know, through probably through an alpha or theta brainwave state, which is, you know, I mean, the regular waking brainwave state is a beta brainwave state. So anytime you go to sleep or you meditate or you take a nap and you kind of hover between waking and sleeping, your brain enters a lower frequency state, like in terms of actual oscillations per second. And in that state, you're closer to your subconscious than if you were in the beta brainwave state. So that is another way of reaching the subconscious, which is to change your state of consciousness to close the gap between your mind and the subconscious mind so that it is more receptive to your suggestions. So yeah, it can be done without emotions, but it's kind of like riding a bicycle with one flat tire. I mean, you can do it, but it's not optimal. So ideally, you would do exactly what Goddard says, which is you have both the emotion and the belief and the visualization, and those together create a very powerful effect. But if your dopamine receptors are burned out and you've got a bad attention span, well, maybe you can do it without emotion, but it'll be tougher.
I suspect there will be some challenges there. I'm thinking about some of these psychotropic and antidepressant medications, not all of them, but given what happened with the engineered pandemic and the enormous power given now to the pharmaceutical industry, could one aspect of spiritual warfare be masquerading as treatment for emotional traumas? Our guest is Tom Montauk. His website, montauk.net, M-O-N-T-A-L-K.net. And we're talking about what might be going on at the quantum level of physics when our intention and emotion interface with reality. Author Jenny Randles mentions in the synchronicity chapter of her book, Time Storms, something she calls homing objects. One of the stories is from American journalist Charles Fort. He writes about a wedding ring lost at sea that turned up years later when the couple ordered a meal and they found that the ring was inside the plated fish. The next story involves a woman who lost a roll of film containing emotionally significant photographs, and 2 years later, in a city miles away, she buys a new roll of film. This is 2 years later, and when that roll of film was developed, somehow the images from the missing roll of film were superimposed on the new roll of images. Her examples continue, and Randles writes, quote, "Here you can get a sense of the emotional and motivational factors that may organize reality so that the right people are in the right places at the right time to bring about synchronicity." These personal accounts, and there are more, again, point to the power of emotion that caused a shift in our time and space reality. I suspect Neville Goddard was also aware of these types of anecdotal evidence. Continuing with the role human emotional energy can have on the influence of our reality, what might be happening with emotional energy interacting with the waveforms on the quantum level?
Well, the quantum level is precisely the key to how this can all work, because it's been shown in quantum physics that what's called retrocausality it's definitely possible. And what that means is that something that you do right now in the present can go back in time and influence things in the past in order to change things back in the present, and therefore also the future. So the thing about emotional energy is that unlike physical energy, like from a battery or from the sun, emotional energy, it exists on what the occultists call the astral plane. And some of it also filters down into what they call the etheric plane, which is right next to the physical plane. Well, these other planes, they are not locked into linear time like our physical energy is. It actually, it's kind of fuzzy. It kind of bleeds into the future and into the past. It's non-local. It's delocalized. So because that emotional energy and the demiurge and the soul and that consciousness energy field, because it extends also through time, not just through space, but it can extend into the past, it can influence little switch points or switches or flip points in the past. You know, it can be weeks ago, months ago, years ago, centuries ago. It can influence those little tiny things so that because of that, the effects of that ripple back into the future and change the present as you know it. Well, okay, so it doesn't change the present that you remember so much. What it does, though, is it changes the probabilities, the shapes of the wave functions in the present so that the future that comes at you now, your experiences that you attract, they're different now. They're going to be shaped differently because the past has changed in a way that affects it. So, like, for example, the woman who found her missing ring inside of a plated fish, well, Maybe her desire to get the ring back was so strong and sustained over such a long period of time that it actually affected the past in such a way that the ring, maybe instead of falling down a sewer grate, it fell down a different one, okay? And it found its way to the ocean and therefore got swallowed by a fish, and the right fisherman just happened to pick it up and eventually, you know, get it delivered as a meal on her plate. And all of that only happened because of one little tiny quantum switch that got flipped, let's say a couple months earlier, that led to that particular fish swallowing it and it ending up on her plate. So that's what I mean by emotion being non-local and affecting the past. That this is all in accordance with the allowed possibilities of quantum physics. And the math and the experiments actually prove that it's possible. So it's not that outlandish. But I must remind people, of course, that quantum physics, as I mentioned, is only the last step in a sequence of processes that ultimately originate in the higher metaphysical planes. So that's why we can also think about the explanation as the dream metaphor, which is not just a metaphor, it's actually probably the way things really work, where if you're in a dream and something happened earlier and you wish to get it back somehow, like you lost your ring in a dream, well, suddenly in the dream, you're eating a fish and there's the ring inside the fish. It makes sense in a dream because, like, hey, you know, anything can happen in a dream. Well, waking reality is not that much different from a dream. It's just a little bit more stubborn, more persistent. Things take longer to manifest, but they eventually do if you put enough energy and time into it.
Well, do you have any last thoughts on this very complicated but fascinating topic?
Definitely. Yeah, there were three other important points I wanted to mention. So the first one is when Neville Goddard says, you know, use this technique to manifest your desires, well, we also have to question where those desires come from, because as everyone knows, we have a devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other shoulder. So, you know, we're dual beings. We have desires coming from different places within our psyche. And so we have to make sure that if we do use this technique, that we are manifesting from a good place. We're manifesting from a place that actually resonates with our heart, our soul, and is in line with our conscience. Because if it's not, you know, if it's coming from a place of ego or shadow or pain or, childhood abandonment, alienation issues or something, and you're driving it with negative emotions, well, that's black magic and it's going to backfire on you. So just make sure you come from a good place when you do it. That's one. The other point is make sure that it's not just about feelings. It's also about your core beliefs and your core assumptions, like your outlook on life. Now, some people have a viewpoint that, let's say, different kinds of programs that are lodged in their subconscious, one of which is money is dirty, you know, or I'm not worthy of a good relationship. These things that are lodged in the subconscious, and they're put there through painful, traumatic experiences in life that the ego and the shadow they build up a defense mechanism against it by saying, like, I hate all women. I don't need women anyway because they're all, you know, fill in the blank. That sort of thing. Well, if you then later in life try to manifest a loving relationship, but you have these time bombs within your subconscious, these booby traps, well, those are going to sabotage your manifesting attempts because they're going to be there, but they're going to be unacknowledged. And if you do get results, those results are going to be mixed because your subconscious is then not only enacting your conscious desire, but it's also going to be enacting those other things in your subconscious that might be conflicting with it. So let's say you might attract a romantic partner, but they might abuse you, take advantage of you. Why? Because they don't think you're worthy and they don't respect you. Why? Because you attracted someone that is resonating with your subconscious issue of not being worthy, of being full of insecurity. So that's why you do have to kind of clean up your soul as much as you can, heal yourself, do inner work, get yourself in a better, more balanced state. And that then works with any of the other more positive feelings that you put into your manifesting practice. So that's point number two. And the last point, if you're someone who decides that, you know what, I'm just going to be a person who just focuses on the feeling of wonder and awe. Like everything is amazing. The universe is amazing. Amazing. Life is full of magic. If you have that mindset and you just go about your day with that, you're going to start attracting the craziest, magical, awe-inspiring synchronicities and positive opportunities. Now, in my experience, it takes about 3 days for it to sort of start kicking in. It takes about 3 weeks for it to get really noticeable. And it takes about 3 months of doing this for it to become like mind-blowing, like you're Neo in the Matrix, you know, bending reality. So if you sustain that over time, it kind of builds upon itself, builds momentum, and starts warping reality more and more. And that is because, unlike a nightly dream, as I mentioned, waking reality is sort of the same thing, but it's takes longer for things to work. So just be patient, keep at it, and if you don't want to do all the meditation, you know, like Goddard-style techniques and which you might find ritualistic, you can just be a certain way and it'll still work. And oh no, and that ties into one last bonus point, which is this, that it turns out that all of us are constantly manifesting. And so if you have a very boring, mundane, apathetic, materialistic mindset, you're going to be manifesting a life that is boring, mundane, and materialistic, where nothing magical ever happens. And so therefore, in that particular path, you might think to yourself, you know, all this reality creation, Goddard stuff, that's BS. It doesn't work. I've never experienced it. But it turns out they are experiencing it right then and there, because they are creating a life of non-magic. So,
Tom, it's been awesome having you on the show. Please remind listeners how to stay in contact with you and your important research.
So if you go to my website, montalk.net, M-O-N-T-A-L-K.net, I've got my contact info there. I've got tons of free articles, free ebooks. And if you go to x.com, Twitter, x.com/TomMontalk, just one word, you'll see my social media feed, and that's where I tend to post most of my content these days. So either one's good for me.
Great articles you post on X. Tom, you and Carissa had produced a multi-part podcast on manifesting and how reality works. Please tell listeners more about this.
Right. So my girlfriend, Carissa, and I, we put together this multi-part podcast series on manifesting, on reality creation, how reality works, all the nuances and anecdotes and cool stories to back it up that I can only allude to here. So anyone who wants to know more, who wants to get like a master class on how this stuff works, definitely check that out on my YouTube channel. It's called the Mind Over Reality.
And you have three books that you've written. Give us those titles, if you would.
Yes, I've got three books. The first one is called Fringe Knowledge for Beginners. You can also find that on Amazon. I have another book on the alien agenda called Discerning Alien Disinformation. And then I have one on, it's a very interesting book about alternative history and the bigger picture of what reality is and how historical events tie into it. And it's called Gnosis. It's called Alchemy, Grail, Ark, and the Demiurge. So, and you can find all these on Amazon's. And the first two books are free on my website, so anyone can download those and have a look.
Nice. Very generous. Tom, thank you again for being on In Other News.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.